Today's Wednesday, November 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president's attorneys turn over his answers to questions from the special counsel.
They're all finished. The written answers are finished.
President Trump says he won't punish the Saudi crown prince over the death of a Washington Post contributor. Well, they chastised Hillary Clinton over it, and now Ivanka Trump is under the microscope over using a personal email account. Also ahead, the true story of an African-American war hero. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump declared Tuesday he would not further punish Saudi Arabia for the murder of U.S.-based columnist Jamal Khashoggi, making clear that the benefits of good relations with the kingdom, in his view, outweigh the possibility its crown prince may have ordered the killing.
I'm not going to destroy the world economy, and I'm not going to destroy the economy for our country by being foolish with Saudi Arabia.
The president condemned the brutal slaying of Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last month as a horrible crime that our country does not condone, but he rejected calls by many in Congress, including members of his own party, for a tougher response and also dismissed reports from U.S. intelligence agencies that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman likely knew about and ordered such an audacious and intricate plot.
The CIA has looked at it. They've studied it a lot. They have nothing definitive. And the fact is, maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
Trump insisted his position reflects his America First foreign policy that's grounded in economic necessity. The statement came after weeks of debate over whether the president would or should come down hard on the Saudis, and the crown prince in particular, in response to the killing of Khashoggi, who'd been critical of the royal family. The U.S. earlier sanctioned 17 Saudi officials suspected of being responsible for or complicit in the October 2nd killing at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. But members of Congress have called for harsher actions, including canceling arms sales. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Ian Lustick, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, what he makes of the president's position.
It's an out-and-out lie with all the exclamation points, and the idea that this is America First is a transparent attempt by the president to justify what is in his own political interest, marginally, I would say, to keep oil prices low, to perhaps keep fueling a boomlet in the American economy that he thinks might be at risk otherwise. And this is filled with misrepresentations and lies. If he doesn't know that the crown prince of Saudi Arabia ordered this murder, I have a bridge in Brooklyn that he might like to buy. He certainly knows it. And I think what he's telling his base is, unlike others, I am willing to lie and do pretty horrible things in order to benefit you, or at least for you to think I'm benefiting you. So I really think that this is one of the low points of American foreign policy in a long time.
You have no doubt that the crown prince ordered the killing of the Saudi journalist?
I don't have any doubt, because Saudi Arabia does not work in a way that a 15-man unit that includes a doctor with a bone saw is sent to Turkey, ends up killing, by even the Saudi acknowledgement, is killing the man there, and that that highest authorities in the country don't know about it. These people, even who have been named by the Saudi government as responsible, are extremely close to the crown prince. No one would lift a finger in these matters without his approval or without his direct order. And I believe that the CIA is very well aware of that, and the president is putting our intelligence officers in a very uncomfortable position, which is one reason I think the CIA leaked the report, to make it clear to anyone who wants to know what the situation is, and that is that President Trump and probably his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who's even closer to the crown prince than the president is, put their own personal interests above the national interest. I would also add that when the president says in the same statement that it's the Iranians who are responsible for the war in Yemen and the Saudis would love to end the war and reconstruct Yemen, that is also a bald-faced lie. And there is no evidence to support that whatsoever. The Iranian presence in Yemen has has been minor. It is minor. It was not what started this war. And the obsession that the president has with Iran is much more important in understanding what he's doing here than many other factors that people might think of.
President referred to Saudi Arabia as a steadfast partner. Is it in the contest with Iran for hegemony in the Middle East?
It is not. It is an instigator. It believes that it is important to rally as much of the world against Iran as possible because the Saudi regime, which is an autocratic, theocratic, extreme regime that has funded Muslim Islamist terrorism in Pakistan, in Syria, all over the world, sees Iran as its enemy, partly because Iran is democratic, even though we might like not like the kinds of governments it elects. It is a republic, and that is a deadly threat to Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have taken a stand against any popular democratic forces whatsoever, whether they are Muslim as the Muslim Brotherhoods or whether they are secular as Pan-Arabism. They are against anything that is democratic and popular. The United States is aligning itself with that regime.
Now, with the U.S. having divided government, do you anticipate Congress will take its own action?
I think they will try. I think they will rake Trump over the coals for this policy, certainly in the House of Representatives, but there are signs that many Republican senators will not swallow this action. I'm not sure exactly what the Senate will do, but it will be very interesting to see if the Senate Foreign Relations Committee follows suit with the kinds of inquiries that I expect the House Committee on Foreign Relations to conduct.
The head of the kingdom, King Salman, on Monday issued an annual policy address. He implicitly or backhandedly praised his son, the Crown Prince, for his role in preparing the next generation for employment in Saudi Arabia. But do you anticipate the king, who has the power to do so, could possibly change the Crown Prince?
Well, there are reports that the king is suffering from Alzheimer's. It is not clear who, for example, would have written that speech other than perhaps his son. It's an opaque society at the top, and it is possible, with pressure from the United States, that there would be changes in the kingdom that would both remove the Crown Prince from his position, but also perhaps continue some sort of reform project in the kingdom. But with the ties that exist between the president and his son-in-law and the Crown Prince, that's something that doesn't look like it's going to be coming from the White House anytime soon.
Do you think the White House statement will encourage the peace process in Yemen?
No, I don't, because it's except if the United States puts pressure on Saudi Arabia in order to live up to a characterization of its policies, which is totally inaccurate. But if we can get the Saudis to adopt a policy of, yes, we want to make peace in Yemen and we're prepared to reconstruct the country, that would be a positive step forward for sure.
That's Ian Lustick, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. How Zimbabwe has changed since Mugabe is gone. Is the U.S. gun violence scaring off foreign students? The U.N. envoy prepares for peace talks in Yemen. And an Israeli school preps teen spies. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. New revelations about the extent of Ivanka Trump's personal email use in the White House will be getting a hard look from House Democrats when they take power in January. According to a published report, Ivanka Trump used her personal email account to conduct White House business. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
First daughter and presidential advisor Ivanka Trump has reportedly sent hundreds of emails about government business from a personal email account. That's according to a report in the Washington Post. The emails were sent to White House aides, cabinet officials, and her assistants. A spokesman says it was while Ivanka Trump was transitioning into government, and nearly all the communications involved logistics and scheduling. Nothing classified was ever sent, and the emails have been retained. President Trump blasted Democratic rival Hillary Clinton for her private email server, evoking the chant of "lock her up" among his followers.
Blast about it on Tuesday at the White House, President Trump told reporters his daughter's personal email use in a White House job is much different from former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's.
They weren't classified like Hillary Clinton. They weren't deleted like Hillary Clinton, who deleted 33. She wasn't hiring. She wasn't doing anything to hide her emails.
Use of a personal account for government business could potentially violate a law requiring preservation of all presidential records. President Trump has submitted written answers to questions from special counsel Robert Mueller in his probe of Russian meddling in the 2016 election and possible collusion with the Trump campaign. Trump signed the submission Tuesday before he left Washington to spend the Thanksgiving holiday in Florida. Joining us now is former Central Intelligence Officer Central Intelligence Agency officer and current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. So the president has said he wrote the questions himself, but how likely would that be that his attorneys would even allow such a thing?
The president may have written them down. He's not the one who came up with the answers. It's very, very clear that his entire team has been working on this for, frankly, for months, because you want to try to get exactly the right answer. Of course, the president said he was very, very happy to sit down with Robert Mueller, but we now notice that he's backing away from that, too.
He said he's done. I would imagine that an investigation like this wouldn't really be up to anyone being investigated. It would be up to the special counsel to determine when it's finished.
Well, that's absolutely right. And there's actually another piece to this. It appears that Bob Mueller has the ability to subpoena this president and could subpoena this president. But the problem is this is all new territory. Nobody knows exactly how far this can go, whether or not you can actually do this two-way sitting president. There's precedent, and yet at the same time, this is somewhat unique. And so everybody is watching and saying, is this a constitutional crisis? And the answer is yes. Yes, it is.
Why is it a constitutional crisis?
The real reason it is because there is very real potential that you could have a sitting president who might be indicted. And there has been a lot of debate about whether that's true. The Justice Department said this is something that you cannot do. And yet at the same time, you can take a look, happened to Bill Clinton, where you could force him to be deposed. That's something that could potentially happen in this case for bad behavior that took place before he was president. That's actually a part of this, because when Bob Mueller is looking at his investigation, it's not just what happened during the presidency. If you find a crime that's been committed even before he was running, there is always the potential that that could lead to criminal charges as well. So that's part of that constitutional crisis that people keep looking at.
But the fact that Mueller settled for written answers that obviously are probably being written by the attorneys, that's definitely not the same as him, as the president sitting down with him under oath and answering questions. Is that why there could be a potential for a subpoena?
Yes. I think in the end, the purpose was get what you can get and then keep pushing. Is it possible that Bob Mueller could actually come back at the president? And the answer is yes. Simply because the president has answered a series of questions doesn't mean that he can't come back and ask for more questions or more answers. It doesn't mean that he couldn't still move forward and say, all right, now that you've answered those, we want you here.
But if the president says he's done, we're finished with this, it's a witch hunt.
My response to the witch hunt is more than 30 indictments, more than 6 guilty pleas, more than 3 sentences, and we're still counting. This proves that it's far more than that, because there have been a lot of people that have been wrapped up, and those numbers continue to accumulate.
What about the fact that the president, after firing Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who had recused himself from overseeing the investigation because of conflict, and therefore Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has been overseeing the Russia investigation, but the president bypassed him and put a Trump supporter, a Trump sympathizer, in that position. There are a lot of people crying foul. There are legal challenges piling up, but we really don't know. If there are speculations that he's already sharing information about what he knows about the investigation with the president, giving him quite an advantage.
No question about it. I mean, that's the problem that we're seeing right now with Matthew Whitaker, is that if you look at his history, you look at his public statements, this strikes me as very consistent with positions the president himself has had, essentially that this is the witch hunt. And the fear, of course, is that if he does become the person capable of actually shutting down an investigation like this, he might actually do so. We were talking about the concept of a constitutional crisis. This literally is the definition of one. In the event that you actually put somebody in place who has not been confirmed by the Senate, who has a purposeful goal that's consistent with your own to actually stop an investigation which may have been a crime that was involving this president himself. That is the definition of a constitutional crisis.
Then why is it just continuing if that's the case? Is there no way to circumvent it?
Here is the real problem. The real problem is that we have never had a situation like this before. In this country, there has not been a history of this kind of behavior. So you can go back and you can take a look at the likes of Richard Nixon. And the thing is Nixon didn't act like this. He simply didn't. And because of that, you saw somebody who finally said, you know what, rather than face this, I'm going to resign. The problem is this president is a completely different animal than we have seen previously. And that's one of the reasons this crisis continues, because we just haven't experienced it before. We just haven't been in the position where we actually had to force the president to do certain things because at some point they decided they couldn't continue. Well, in this case, this president continued.
That's criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Thanks for being with us. Meanwhile, the top Democrat in the U.S. Senate, Chuck Schumer, called Tuesday for the Justice Department's internal investigator to review communications between acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker and the White House. Schumer said he wants the Justice Department's inspector general to look into whether Whitaker, in the top echelon of the agency before Trump appointed him as head of it for as long as 210 days, had access to confidential grand jury information obtained in Mueller's investigation, and whether he may have shared any of it with Trump or other White House officials. Whitaker, before joining the Justice Department, had been critical of Mueller's probe, saying a replacement attorney general, such as he is now, could cut funding to the probe so that it, quote, grinds almost to a halt. With migrant caravans traveling through Central America to get to the U.S., a federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to accept asylum seekers no matter where or how they enter the U.S. The Department of Justice Tuesday said it would continue to defend President Trump's decision to make immigrants who enter the country illegally from Mexico ineligible for asylum. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
As the caravans of migrants started arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border, President Trump said the asylum ban was necessary to stop what he's called a national security threat. But U.S. District Judge John Tiger, an Obama appointee, says whatever the scope of the president's authority, he may not rewrite the immigration laws to impose a condition that Congress has expressly forbidden. Those laws allow people, no matter how they get into the U.S., to apply for asylum. Trump's proclamation said anyone crossing the southern border had to use an official entry point or would be ineligible for asylum. As of Monday, 107 people detained entering the U.S. illegally have sought asylum, according to the Department of Homeland Security. I'm Julie Walker.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
VOA's International Edition continues. A recently released book, Sergeant Rodney M. Davis, The Making of a Hero, was written by our next guest, author John Hollis. It tells the story of the life, death, and courage of an African-American U.S. Marine during the Vietnam War. You just wrote this fascinating book based on a true story.
Correct.
And, you know, it really has significance, not just because it's about a war hero, but it's about a person of color that is a war hero. So first of all, who is this person that inspired you enough to write this book?
Sure. Sergeant Rodney M. Davis is one of 88 African Americans who have ever been awarded the Medal of Honor in our nation's history, of the roughly 3,500 that have been awarded since 1861. The story of his death was riveting because because he basically gave his life to save the lives of five Marines in September 6, 1967, all of whom who happened to be white. He was African-American. And the timing was made significant because at that time, more than 150 American cities had endured race riot that summer of 1967. But the beauty of the story was the country was going crazy with the issue of black and white in America in 1967, but 10,000 miles away, the closest thing to hell on earth, these 200 Marines withstood an onslaught from an MDA force estimated to be almost 2,500 men. It didn't matter what color they were, didn't matter where they were from, what their daddy did, as long as the guy beside them had each other's back. These Marines were brothers through and through. 10,000 miles away, in the closest thing to hell on earth, these guys had it right. The kind of brotherhood that America is supposed to be about. Honor, courage, commitment. There's a story about duty, commitment, and sacrifice.
Was he doing something he technically wasn't really allowed to be doing because he was African American?
No, he was not. He was the right guy, a platoon right guy, which is in a Marine platoon is the third highest in command. Basically, he accompanied 200 Marines walking to a trap set by 2,500 MDA. They were overrun. It was hand to hand combat, and there was so much chaos and carnage and shooting everywhere. And an enemy grenade landed at their feet. The other five Marines in the trench with him, because of all the cacophony of noises, did not see or hear the grenade at their feet. Sergeant Davis was the only one who saw it, at least he was the first one who saw it, jumped on it, used both hands, stuffed it underneath his body to save the lives of his Marines. He'd been in country 3 weeks. People who looked like him were being still treated like second-class citizens in his own country. If he brought the same Marines home to Macon, Georgia, would not have been allowed to eat in the same restaurants with them. But he loved his fellow Marines, he loved his country that much, to willingly give his life, always ingrained at a young age to look out for his siblings. He had four siblings, three brothers and a sister. And looking out for them, and while coming up from Jim Crow, was always one of the charges his parents instilled in him. And he would do no less for his new brothers in the U.S. Marine Corps. He died as nobly as he lived.
Wow. So there's such a tragic irony there, you know, that the privileges of war were different than everyday life back then.
Exactly. The Marine Corps and the military in so many ways had it right as far as, you know, of course, President Truman in 1948 issued the presidential executive order integrating the military. That was 6 years before Brown versus Board of Education, which formally declared separate was not equal. So in a lot of ways, the military has been on the cutting edge on the social change in America. And that was a perfect example as well.
And he died and he was only 25 years old, huh?
That's correct. He'd been in country 3 weeks, and he had been an embassy guard, at U.S. Marine Embassy Guard in London. But like most Marines, when there's fighting going on, Marines run to it. Marines are a different breed, a special breed. And he'd been in country 3 weeks when he was killed. It was one of the fiercest battles of the entire Vietnam War.
So the book is based on the story that you just basically told.
I talk also about the parallels going on. Like I said, he was one of five kids raised by his parents in Macon, Georgia. And again, the threat of violence and humiliation of being treated like a second-class citizen was always very real every time they left their house. So their parents raised them from a young age to always look after your brothers, your three brothers and your sister, always look after your siblings. And so that's what he knew. That's the way he was raised, always look after his brothers. So he was just doing the same thing he'd been done his whole life. Fascinating story. And one of the last chapters of the book, I detail with each of those five Marines in that trench with them, what they've done the last 50 years. All of them went on to live exemplary lives. He did amazing things. One platoon sergeant, who's to his immediate left, is a retired millionaire living in Denmark, just welcomed his third great-grandchild last year, or 2 years ago. The platoon commander, who's to his immediate right, he curled into a ball expecting to die when the grenade is there, and lived only because Sergeant Davis' action. He died of natural causes a few years ago, but I was there at Marine Corps Base Quantico in November 2014 when his eldest grandson graduated from OCS, Officer Candidate School, and he's now an active duty Marine Corps officer. So it's like a rock skipping across a lake. This gift of life just keeps on giving every day.
All right. Thanks so much for sharing your story, or the story, author John Hollis. The book is called Sergeant Rodney M. Davis, The Making of a Hero. Oscar nominee Matthew Heineman's film, A Private War, about Sunday Times war correspondent Marie Colvin, who risked her life on the war fronts of Sri Lanka, Iraq, and Syria, brings attention to the danger that war correspondents face reporting on the plight of war victims. Oscar-nominated actress Rosamund Pike plays Colvin. Heineman and Pike told VOA's Penelope Pulu how and why A Private War was a labor of love, a docudrama delving into Marie Colvin's psyche.
In war zones, parents go to bed at night, not knowing if their children will see the morning. That is a measure of fear that I can never feel.
In A Private War, actress Rosamund Pike transforms herself into Marie Colvin, a gritty, fierce, inquisitive British journalist who dedicated her life reporting on atrocities around the world.
Stay down. I'm not armed! Journalist! America!
Losing her left eye from a rocket-propelled grenade in Sri Lanka in 2001 did not slow her down. But the scars of conflict took a mental and physical toll. Rosamund Pike emotes Marie Colvin's inner struggles.
I'm most happy with a vodka martini in my hand, but I can't stand the fact that the chatter in my head won't go quiet until there's a quart of vodka inside me. I hate being in a war zone. But I also feel compelled. Compelled to see it for myself.
Everything. I had to learn to smoke, you know, convincingly. Because she, you know, for Marie, everything was better with a cigarette. Every conversation, every car drive. I had to see the way she gestured with her hands. She had these wide apart fingers. I had to work out how the eye patch made her angle her head differently. You know, how she could penetrate and sear you with one eye as good as someone else could, you know, dress you down with two.
Filmmaker Matthew Heineman looks at the complexity of Colvin's character, her courage and drive to get the story out. He shows how she never flinched, even under Bashar al-Assad's heavy bombardment of the city of Homs in Syria in 2012.
Let me go. Hey, we will freaking die if we go back.
Felt compelled to tell the story, to tell the story of a group of 28,000, you know, civilians in Homs who were besieged by the Assad regime, and no one else was doing that. And she felt, as she often did, if I don't do this, then who will?
As a documentarian, Heineman wanted to give this real-life texture to his film. In a scene when Colvin discovers a mass grave in Iraq, the local women and men gathered around mourning are real victims of war.
And, you know, at the end of that scene, like in any documentary that I made, you know, something unforeseen happened. They started chanting and doing this prayer for the dead.
Rosamund Pike relates a similar experience she had while filming an unscripted scene with a refugee woman huddled with her kids in a safe house during the siege of Homs in Syria. Through a translator, the woman tells Pike how she feeds her baby only sugar and water because she cannot produce milk to breastfeed after the trauma of losing one of her kids to a bomb attack.
The woman said to me, as Marie, and it was caught on camera, she said, I don't want this. She said, please, I don't want this just to be words on paper. I want the world to know that a generation is dying here. I want this, the world to know my story.
Pike says, at that moment, she felt what drove Colvin. The journalist's grave responsibility to bear witness to people's suffering, no matter the cost.
Maybe I would have liked a more normal life. Maybe I just don't know how.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.